You are listening to Conversations in the Gospel of John, Episode 4. This episode was recorded in the spring of 2023 at Fringe University in Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
Hi, I'm Douglas, and I currently teach at Fringe University. Before becoming an academic, I was a pastor for 15 or 16 years, and I hold a PhD in theology from the University of Nottingham.
I've been involved with teaching and preaching in Baptist congregations for the past 30 years. I currently teach at Fringe University in Wichita, Kansas, and hold a PhD in biblical studies from Baylor University. We're so thankful that you're choosing to listen to our conversation. Today, we're talking with Sherry Brown, who is an associate professor at Creighton University up in Nebraska. And so, Sherry, what would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Hi, thanks, Doug and Stan, for having me for this conversation. I'm really happy to be here. I, as you said, am associate professor of New Testament at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. I've been here for about 9 years. I grew up in the East in West Virginia and have my PhD in biblical studies from the Catholic University of America.
Well, that's wonderful. We're so glad to have you just up the road, as they might say, from Wichita to Omaha. Lots of things going on between those towns. So let's start the conversation, Sherry, by telling us what caused you to be interested in the Gospel of John way back when you were studying at some point in your career.
Yeah, it's hard to say because I've always responded to that question with, well, the Gospel of John was my first love. I'm not sure sort of when that love began, but even, you know, as a teenager, an undergrad, the Gospel of John always spoke to me in ways that maybe the other Gospels didn't. And as I was pursuing my master's program, I always wanted to do a seminar on John, and one was never available. And then I spent some time in the Peace Corps and international development, finally went back for my doctoral program and heard that Frank Maloney was at the Catholic University of America at the time. And so that's where I started my program. For folks who don't know, Frank Maloney is a master scholar on the Gospel of John.
He's a legend.
And so I ended up doing all my studying with him. Yeah, and he became a great mentor to me, and we continue to work together.
So, Sherry, as someone who loves the Gospel but is also a fully qualified scholar of the Gospel, what is the method that you use when reading the Gospel, or what's your favorite approach?
So, as a proper student of Frank Maloney, I was trained in what we call a literary approach, or specifically a narrative approach to the Gospel, which certainly takes into account the historical context and the time and place and setting of the ancient world and the writing of the Gospel of John, but takes also very seriously the evangelist as author, as one who had these traditions and, of course, in the Gospel claims to have been an eyewitness, but shapes the material in such a way for an intended audience, as we say, the audience that he was looking to, maybe his community, and shaping the story and telling what he felt they needed to hear in order to affirm their faith, strengthen the community. And John, of course, is our one gospel. Well, like the Gospel of Luke, John actually tells us that toward the end, in John 20, 30, 31, he says, and I'm paraphrasing, I'm not reading it, now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, but these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ and Son of God, and that you may have life in his name. So he says that he's picked and chosen and shaped his narrative in this way. And so I go back, you know, to the beginning, what we call the prologue, John 1, 1 to 18, as a first page, as an introduction, and follow the shape of the narrative. and using all of the things that the tools that we think about when we think about narrative, character, plot, setting, story arcs, all of that good stuff.
So we've been talking a little bit about ahead of time about women in the gospel, and sometimes that's a tremendous approach. There are quite a few to talk about in John's gospel as opposed to the other three. But let's talk about that one who doesn't have a name. She's just simply the mother of Jesus. So tell us about John 2 and the wedding and the mother of Jesus. And what have you been thinking about her lately as a just an overall big picture item? You love the story. Tell us why you love the story.
Yeah, well, like you said, I have been focusing on the role of women again, and this with this narrative, and you might even say feminist approach, feminist in the sense of a concern for the role of women and sort of a collaborative approach. And oftentimes people don't think about John as particularly feminist or one who focuses on the role of women. But if we take seriously this narrative and the way that he writes, we have longer, deeper, more far-reaching encounters between Jesus and women that really sort of shape the narrative or shape the direction of Jesus's ministry and what God is doing through Jesus in John than any of our other gospels. And all of this begins at John 2. So again, only the second chapter, obviously, and Jesus has just begun his ministry. He's gathered disciples over the course of the first couple days of the narrative, the end of chapter 1. And then we're told that on the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And as you say, she's always referred to by the narrator, by the author, as the mother of Jesus. She's never given a name. You know, we have to believe. We don't often want to make assumptions or presumptions about what our authors know or don't know, but her name was given prominently in other gospels. Toward the end of the narrative, we're told that our author, narrator, and the mother of Jesus were given to each other by Jesus. I'll come back to that. So he must have known her name, I think we can say. So what is he doing there by always referring to her as the mother of Jesus?
I'm gonna let you finish up, but here's a thought that I had, because we're recording this shortly after Easter, and we're reading through Luke, and there's way too many Marys in some of those synoptics to keep track of who the heck they're talking about. So I think that, you know, just a random thought is he didn't want to get her confused with any other Mary that might be in the story. So what do you think about the reference to Mother of Jesus?
So, again, you know, sort of if we take this narrative approach, this would be the first Mary, right? And this is our sort of opening encounter. If anything, you might suspect he would highlight her as the Mary and maybe unname the others, right, later in the gospel or something like that. So I think that by always referring to her as the mother of Jesus, he's actually highlighting her role as mother. And notice at the same time, Jesus always refers to her as woman. He addresses her as woman here in John 2, and he does it again on the cross at John 19. So in terms of character shaping, character building, it highlights her role as woman and mother. And as woman and mother, she inaugurates Jesus's public ministry. She sort of facilitates the beginning of his activity in public at John 2 at this wedding in Cana. So I think sort of that is in terms of what John is doing by shaping it this way. I think he's starting off the story by highlighting the role of a woman and mother, and by leaving her unnamed, highlighting the role of all women and mothers, you know, in this way.
So one of the questions, let me dig a little deeper in this. One of the questions that you get if you're in a local church and you're reading this passage is, why in the world does Jesus refer to his mom as mother? That seems so cold or unusual or weird. And I know you and I both know there's lots of theories, but from a narrative perspective, how do you answer that question in a couple of sentences with a layperson.
Why does he refer to her as woman?
Yeah, exactly.
As woman, yeah.
Yeah, and so I think it's true. You know, you always, whenever you're sort of reading this passage, you know, with folks, they're like, how rude, you know? And then it almost seems like he rebukes her. But I think we need to be careful with how we read what the evangelist says and exactly what he says. And I think sometimes our English translations don't serve us too well in that. But I just want to say that, I just want to bring up that Jesus does refer to her as woman, but he also refers to her as woman again at John 19 when we next see her. There's no way that you could, that one could interpret that as that encounter as rude or oppositional. And he actually refers to other women as woman. So however unusual it is, I think from a character building standpoint, from a narrative standpoint, it's allowing both John as evangelist and Jesus as minister to highlight the fact that he's encountering these women, and these women are helping to shape his ministry. In this encounter, you know, she comes to him and says, they have no wine. Oftentimes this is restated by folks that she requests a miracle. She requests a miracle from him. Well, that's not what she does. She actually, all she actually does is sort of make known or reveal, you know, the lack in the wedding. And we can do lots of historical contextualization about ancient weddings and this sort of honor involved in providing abundant food and wine to the guests, which would suggest that the hosts are in a potentially shameful situation by running out of wine. We can also talk about, and that maybe she's trying to help allay that potentiality. We can also talk about, if we go back to the Jewish scriptures, how the prophets would speak of, you know, the coming of the Messiah, the sort of revelation of the Messiah as a banquet with abundant food and wine. So there's that symbolism there too. And then Jesus's response to her is this, you know, age-old, very complicated question. Given the larger sort of symbolism here of a messianic banquet and what John 1 has set us up for with sort of the potential revelation of the glory of God, I suggest what Jesus is doing is challenging her. I mean, it's definitely a strong saying. He's not rebuking her and saying, I'm not doing this. He's saying, what is between you and I? Are you ready to sort of be a part of what God is doing through me? And she responds, interestingly enough, not by talking to him, but by turning to the servants and saying, do whatever he tells you.
Well, I think that opening statement by Jesus, the statement is really the wrong word. You know, I've always read that as kind of a phatic statement, which means it's a euphemism, like almost in English, we would say, yo, what's up? You know, so it's, in fact, as you said, Sherry, it's not designed at all to be confrontational. It's designed to be, in my opinion, relational. Let me dig in with what you were saying a little bit, because I think a lot of times pastors, if they're teaching this or if you have a Bible study or something like that, you can go the historical route. But then people's eyes glaze over when we start talking about, yeah, you know, the weddings in the ancient world, and people don't care. And then we can talk about the symbolic, but then it's easy to turn that into a free-for-all. Narrative, though, the beauty of narratives is focus on story. So when you think about this story, this is the first sign. Why does John put this or make this the first sign that he narrates? I mean, what is the importance here? Like, if you're trying to explain to a layperson and you only had a couple of sentences, what would be the gist that John wants to get here?
And does Mary's role,
yeah,
have a significant part in this?
Is it inaugurative
sign?
Yeah.
And the woman role.
I think this scene inaugurates Jesus' public ministry, but it also sort of presents who Jesus is going to be in this gospel. Jesus in this gospel is challenging, is provocative, he's welcoming, but he's going to push you further than you thought you could go. I think it's a very strong opening, and it incorporates women as with men in Jesus's disciple, his close community. She acts, then the servant acts, and then we only come back to those disciples, the ones that arrive with him at the end, and find out that they've been so far they've been watchers, right? They're not doers yet. But Jesus begins to reveal his glory. They begin to believe in him. And then the whole crowd leave the wedding and move on. Men, women, the whole sort of group together.
I want to pick up on one thing you said, is that Jesus is, I'll use the word provoking, those who would follow him, perhaps believe in him, to move beyond. Perhaps, and the fun part about narrative is sometimes we have to try and read a backstory of what may have happened to get to that point, that perhaps Mary, as the mother of Jesus, has already had some encounters where he has challenged her to believe differently about this coming Messiah, and that she is starting to act out or act away from a cultural prescribed behavior to a kingdom prescribed behavior of caring for those who might be in need. Who might be facing shaming, public shaming because of their lack of wine. Any thoughts on how the mother of Jesus came to be such a provocateur herself in crossing those boundaries and bringing the need forward?
Yeah, I really like that idea of she's really caring for others by bringing this situation to Jesus, by making the need plain for him. It allows Jesus, with her leadership, you would say, to maintain the community and to keep people, you know, sort of in community. So it's a model for helping, and it's a model for sort of stepping up when you see people in need. I agree very much, and I think we see that in encounters with Jesus all across the gospel. He's going to keep pushing you to be better, but he wants you on board now, right?
Right.
You don't have to be perfect before you begin. He wants folks really in their imperfection, in their flaws, continuing to act, continuing to grow. We think of Nicodemus, you know, he's a fan favorite. And we're all going to continue having our good days and bad, right? Having our solid days and our fragile days. And I think in this gospel, Jesus, he still wants you,
yes.
Right?
And
he still wants you in relationship now.
It's easy for us to always focus on Jesus, and that's the challenge of narratology, is to look at the other characters and the role that they play and to ask those questions.
Let me ask a practical question, Sherry. Let's say that you had a student who was teaching a Bible study, and they came to you and said, I get the whole wedding thing. I need two or three solid points or takeaways for John 2. What would be the things that you would say you've got to include when you cover this passage?
I would say that this won't be a surprise, given the last 20 minutes or so, that you've got to emphasize the potentiality of women right alongside the men as key disciples of Jesus. I mean, she becomes a model disciple. When she's challenged by Jesus, she responds in the affirmative and gets the action going. She probably still has lots of processing to do about that encounter and lots of processing to do about their relationship and who she understands Jesus to be and who she understands herself to be in that relationship. But she gets going anyway, right? And it's in the process, in the journey, that we learn and become who we are, whether or not we have it all figured out at the beginning or not. I also would suggest, again, that sometimes we find ourselves in situations where there's a lack, a need. Maybe we have a lack or a need, and we might feel, or we find ourselves, as she does, in a situation where others are in need or and need our caring, and we might be wondering why God, if we, is God acting? Well, God can act in us and through us, and so we see that Jesus begins to reveal His glory through the actions of these other people, His mother and the disciples. Nobody actually knows that a miracle has occurred. All the people saying, "Oh my God, this wine is great. This wedding is fantastic." They have no idea that God, Jesus, has acted in their midst. Only sort of this inner circle that is, and the relationship that's formed there. We may never know how profoundly God, Jesus, may be acting in us as we step forward to try to care for others or respond to a need.
I noticed
but we
that
still got to do it.
I noticed that you didn't prioritize the six jars and their significance in the temple purification ceremonies, but which is great that you didn't. We don't want that to happen. But as we begin to move towards a closing on this, oftentimes this passage gets preached and we hear them, and you've given us two really good points for things to cover. But what do you think one or two things are that usually get missed when you hear this talked about in a homily or a sermon or even a someone talking about John 2, even in a commentary sometimes, that they miss the point because they're not looking at it from a narratological perspective, perhaps. They're too historical or too rhetorical in their approach.
Well, I think they can miss the point of the dialogue, you know, as between Jesus and his mother, focusing on the wrong things. And I like what Doug said, that it's sort of a greeting. It's just a relational encounter. I think it's okay to call something a challenge without calling it negative, right? That we all need to be challenged. And I think he does challenge her. I don't think it's remotely negative, you know, in the way that he interacts with her. But that she is, in fact, woman and mother also highlights the role that we can all take. And so I think that that she inaugurates this public ministry and becomes this model disciple that we then can encounter these. If we even are his very next encounter, you know, in the temple area with the Jewish leadership and how they respond to her, if we've got her as a model, then we're like, okay, they need help.
They're need help.
Off base, right?
that is,
you know,
for certain.
They're really, they don't get it at all, you know? And so if we can use her as a model for, you know, these future encounters too.
Yeah, she is an opening and closing model for sure. Well, Sherry, we want to thank you for taking time on this fine day to talk with us about the mother of Jesus, even though we oftentimes refer to her as Mary when the text doesn't. And we just bring in our other knowledge, and we look forward to the writings that you're working on and those coming out to further illuminate us and be available. Thank you for joining us on episode 4 as we discuss the mother of Jesus in John chapter 2. Our next episode will feature a conversation with Christopher Skinner from Loyola University in Chicago. We will be talking about John chapter 20. We hope you'll join us. Bye now.